This is the last center that I am visiting for the last 5 weeks. I have visited the lay centers in Canada, New Jersey, and in New York, directly involved with social services. I feel it is an honor to share with you the life and work of the churches in the Philippines. Yesterday's session, I touched a little something about when the Americans came, they brought Protestantism to the country. That was between the late 1800s and early late 1700s and the early beginning of the 18th century. In 1905, the American missionaries started coming in. It was kind of an arrangement that the islands, the three islands were divided into some sort of missionary areas, so that Mindanao, which is way up north of the country, would be assigned to Baptist Alliance, Assemblies of God, and Pentecostal groups. And Visayas would be assigned to Philippine Episcopal, Presbyterian, and United Church. Luzon would be assigned to Methodist missionaries, in such a way that they did not proselyte one another, because at that time the hostilities were very strong against people who embraced Protestantism. The Philippines, being predominantly a Roman Catholic, it's 75% Catholic and 25% Protestants. These Protestant groups would be divided among Anglicans, Lutherans, United Methodist, United Church, Baptist Alliance, Pentecostal, Mormons, we have now Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witness, and Muslims. So you can see that the other 25% is divided into these other groups. In order to fill up the work for the church then in the early 1900, between 1910 and 1920, the American soldiers, as well as the American missionaries, started to build theological schools too, as a training school for our ministers and church workers. The training was quite crude, in such a way that most of the Filipinos did not finish high school. But for as long as they knew English, then they would be taken in to work in the church. So when they finished grade 4, they were very eloquent already with English. So they were taken in as Bible teachers. There was a saturation, there was sort of a very wide evangelization in these different islands with all these missionaries going in, going through, until the Second World War, when the Japanese invaded the Philippines. And some of these missionaries had to be sent home or had to be jailed by the Japanese. In the early 1930s, we can see that there was already an increase of Protestants in the country, although the Roman Catholics were still very hostile. Now, what would be the forms of worship that the Filipinos said? It would be purely westernized, you know. So they adapted these hymns of America, the hymns that were being sung in the Presbyterian, in the Episcopal, or in the United Methodist. It was very American. And until now, if you come to our place, you will not be a stranger in our worship, because the way we worship is almost the same as yours. And there is now a move for the Protestant church to find indigenous ways of worshiping, because we really don't have yet a very unique way of Filipino worship, in a sense that we had always been dependent on the Americans for this liturgy that we are using, the form of liturgy that we are using. In 1950, just after the outbreak of the war, more missionaries came into the Philippines to help in the rehabilitation, especially in placing back the churches where they had been. It would be significant to note at this point that with the opening of the public, with the intensification of religious education, the missionaries were able to penetrate our public school system. They introduced what we call religious education, or what we call now campus ministry. So hand in hand with the Roman Catholic Church, these missionaries would be allowed to go to our schools to tell stories, Bible stories to these young children, you know, or even to go into some kind of evangelization. This went through until the early 1960s, when the Roman Catholic, when the Roman Catholic Church started to see that there were more young children attending our religious education classes. So in the early 1980s, the government instituted a policy saying that from now on there will be no religious education. It should be optional, and it will be held outside of the classrooms. This made it difficult because from then on, the missionaries who have left, you know, who have left the schools, were very influential in working with these people. You know, when you are white, we have a very high respect for people who come from the Western world. There was some kind of a power that is respected by these schools. In the early 80s, the Mormons came. It was a kind of religion which some Filipinos thought was fascinating. You know, this family-centered kind of thing that they introduced, some felt that it was also answering some of these problems of families. And then we have a very unique religious sect now in the Philippines. We call it Iglesia Ni Cristo, or Church of Christ, which was founded by a Filipino. The doctrines are very Filipino. It's just that they don't believe in Jesus as the Son of God. They don't celebrate Christmas. They don't celebrate Easter. But the way of life that they have, you know, is very communal in a sense that they take care of their members. They know each other very well. There's a personal relationship. And, you know, when this kind of religion exists, people would just want to grab it. In the early 1985 and 1990, we had these charismatic groups or these fundamentalist groups coming into the country. So people from the mainline churches, when I say mainline churches, this would be these big denominations, right? Presbyterian, Lutheran, Anglican, Methodist, United Church, were going into these fundamental groups. We are not really increasing membership through evangelism. We are losing. We are only increasing biologically. This is the problem now of the Protestant Church. There are two councils of churches in the Philippines. I understand you have here National Council of Churches in America. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. We have two there. We have the National Council of Churches in the Philippines, which would include the United Church, the Methodist, the Anglicans, the Lutherans, and the Philippine Episcopal. And we would have the Philippine Council of Evangelical Churches, which would include the Baptist, the Alliance, the Pentecostal. Sort of, you know, the National Council would be the progressive group, and the Philippine Council of Evangelical Churches would be the moderate or the conservative group. It's very difficult to say that at this point in time, the Protestant Church is really gaining many members. There are many questions that our young people are trying to search for. Like some of our programs are mostly Western, that they do not respond to the needs. And ironical, but I would like to share with you that the United Methodist Church of the Philippines is still connected with the United Methodist Church of America. It has not really been independent, in a way that the funds of the United Methodist Church are still very much supported by the United Methodist Church of America. One of the problems that we are struggling right now is autonomy in the church itself. Because sometimes people, you know, who like to be connected with a bigger church in America would have more benefits than those working directly with churches. They receive salaries in the amount, you know, dollars in dollars, and the Filipino ministers and church workers would be receiving pesos. So you can see the discrepancy. Average income of our pastors is about, when you convert them to dollars, is about $220. They get free housing. Sometimes they get free transportation, also gasoline allowance, and that's all. We sometimes in our churches are confronted also with the problems of losing our young people. No, most of them, I think, do not attend our church anymore. So the families are left, you know, the older people also are left to take out its life and work of the church. We have been losing people in the ministry. Most of our young ministers are here now in America. They don't, if ever they have a chance to get scholarships here, hardly do they come to Manila anymore, back to the Philippines. Why? Because they feel that America gives them better benefits than us. So the drain of trained ministers also is a threat now to the church in the Philippines. Tonight, half of what we will do is I will present to you a slide of the center, which an American missionary founded just after the World War. This is the center where I work right now, called Kapatiran Kaunlaran Foundation Incorporated, which was founded by a missionary. We are very indebted to most of these missionaries who left legacies of work there that until now we are trying to continue. And most of these missionaries preferred to die in the Philippines than come back. So you can see how the relationship is with the Protestant Church of the Philippines and the Protestant Church here in the States. But throughout my stay here in Holden, one of the significant things I learned was, I think your churches are more progressive in dealing with social issues rather than our churches. We are still very conservative, especially in discussing gay and lesbianism. Because, you know, we come from a culture where it's too close with one another that we have not taken really the problem of gay and lesbianism. Or probably some of our churches have responded to social issues like human rights, you know, hungers, drug and social problems related to those, but not really with specific issues which you are in now. The center which I'm working right now is trying to conduct seminars related to women's empowerment, because the church there in the Philippines is still very patriarchal in nature. Very few women ministers are still ordained because they do not go into theological training. So but most of our churches too are run by women in such a way that they do the social activities. They prepare, we usually say the women do prepare church suppers, you know, do the fundraising. They are the life of the church, you know, they move the church. But it's just that the leadership is not yet that recognized. And one thing that I learned here is, you know, the openness of the Protestant church, especially you people in the Lutheran church, on taking up these issues. And for me, these are eye-openers.
I think you have to recognize that this is a select place, too, that out there it's not as open as
Really?
Uh-huh. It's an awfully lot of individual churches, to a large extent, and there's a lot of things that aren't very open in the national or the larger groups.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm glad you're telling me this, because I may be getting some general impressions, which I have to correct now, because tomorrow I will leave. Can you tell me more then about some things that is happening in your own church, so that I will also learn from you?
Well, Well, you mentioned the gay and lesbian problem, and it has been quite a divisive situation, with some groups fighting very hard against it, and others recognizing people and being open and accepting those individuals. And, there's other situations of the same type of thing.
But I really appreciated the fact that right here, I'm beginning to be more aware that these are issues that probably my church has just been blind or has not been aware of. And one of the things that struck me was the church also should respond to these issues. So at the during the last part, may I share with you the slides which I brought from the Philippines to show to you the kind of service that our church is responding to. This is a church-related center that is responding also to the social issues and problems of Manila, a city, a big city, that is filled up with street children, homeless, urban poor, and all sorts. So, Russ, can we have the slides now?
Commitment to God's mission. In the heart of Manila lies a bottle, its third district named after the tamarind tree that once sprouted the region. And the corner of Pipa, Redis, and Lerman Street is a compound whose cluster of facilities is a living testimony of love and faith of 4 decades of the people's commitment.
It's a crowded city, though.
San Paolo, famous for its so-called university belt.
This is one of the oldest Roman Catholic universities, founded in early 1500s.
The University of the East.
That's our form of transportation. We call it the jeepney.
Rich history as a center of religion, commerce, and learning. Its human traffic is a natural daily occurrence. In a year where in June 1950, the Methodist Social Center was born. Founded by Madeline G. Klepper, an American Methodist missionary, it started there citing poverty-stricken families in a congested district. Her concern for their well-being became the inspiration of the 4 decades we now celebrate.
If you can see those are squatters, you know, houses just on top of the other. And that is just at the back of our center.
Organized the Boy and Girl Scouts and helped mothers and unemployed adults engage.
These are some of the mothers we help train for them to earn a living because they're living right in the squatter area. That is our center now.
Hall dormitory for ladies, transferred from Taft Avenue as the number of residents who wish to reside there increased.
These are our dormitories for about 400 students.
Care for the poor. Ms. Klepper retired in 1967. Ms. Ruth Garcia presented and took over as executive director. She renovated the mission house and completed the annex.
The second director was married to a person who went underground during Marcos.
She worked for the incorporation of the Methodist Social Center under the name Apatiran Kaunlaran Foundation Incorporated. This made donations to KKFI tax exempt. The center had 2 officers in charge after Mrs. Prudente resigned in 1972. They were Ms. Elisea Casel, who would be Director of Community Development Projects, and Reverend Eduardo Cahiwat.
Reverend Cahiwat now is in Dallas, Texas, so
after
he has
serving as volunteer,
and we lost him too.
Nelly Lapson Mercado
accepted our
executive directorship in 1973. With her administration, projects were integrated to ensure a solid development.
These are children from our urban poor. They get preschool education
to work
in our
towards
center.
The attainment of total human development among members of its partner individuals and communities. This mission is enshrined in its programs
You can see here the houses, you know, they are very poor. This is the basketball court which we use when we offer them to play.
Takes charge of the projects that lead to KKFI's self-reliance. Renting out its commercial apartments supports its programs and services. It is proud of its Hugh Wilson Hall Dormitory for Ladies.
This is the total
which
building
now
itself.
The new annex building, raising the total capacity to 420. Its residents are assured of well-maintained facilities and developmental activities, like Bible studies and fellowship. The fast food center serves employees, boarders, and participants in seminars. The guest house is home to delegates and lift-in workshops and to foreign visitors. A pleasant venue for local and international conferences is the seminar hall, while for smaller meetings, it is the conference room.
Sports that seminar hall was damaged by the earthquake, and we just
in the gymnasium.
It caved in, and we just renovated.
Headed by the foundation's chaplain, the Pastoral Concerns Department focuses on the spiritual needs of the KKFI community. It sponsors worship services, Bible studies and training, pastoral counseling, and theological
conferences.
Nursery, junior, and senior kindergarten classes are conducted by the Early Childhood Education Department for children from economically handicapped families, and even those who can donate for the school's maintenance. Their major activities include the United Nations Parade, the King and Queen Contest, and the recognition ceremonies.
These kinds of celebrations are influenced by the Spaniards, you know, this fiesta thing, where we have the Queen, the Princess.
The Social Services and Community Development Department. Its summer work camp for out-of-school youth develops leadership and teamwork. Its loose group is given by
this is one of the favorite programs of Ms. Klepper, the youth summer camp.
Community school assures community children of a culture and recreation-filled week. Out of school youth and jobless adults gain employable skills in its job school training assistance program, which also conducts seminars on social issues, labor law, and leadership. A small business of men's family income is the aim of the cash loan assistance program for indigent families. Medical clinic renders for them free consultation and medicines, which the dental clinic does as well, though it requests a minimal fee from the general public. The Anapkalita sponsorship program provides social services, including cultural enrichment, to children of urban poor families from Metro Manila, and shifts their heads to be engaged in livelihood-generating projects. Children abandoned by parents and left on the streets
are
temporarily cared for at the drop-in center for street children. They engage in value inculcation and income-generating activities. They are later reunited with their families or returned to other agencies. The Participatory Development Department conducts participatory management for people's empowerment and self-reliance program with the theme enhancing the organizing and management capabilities of church and community leaders for people's empowerment and self-reliance. Composed of audios that include basic participatory management skills, community organizing for women's empowerment, and management of socio-economic projects, the program is conducted for church and civic leaders nationwide and for urban poor leaders in Manila. Periodic consultations with people's organizations and support institutions reinforce the program's participatory thrust. It publishes a newsletter called Kapatira. The Women and Family Department is so named to amplify Kapatiran's mission to develop and empower women and the family. Women's Desk informs the public of the causes and effects of women's exploitation.
This is one of our red light districts where women are
and sponsors.
But we do a lot of helping the prostituted women come to our centers and they get some kind of jobs.
There are two therapeutic communities, which
this is our day center for the elderly.
Rehabilitation centers for drug abuse victims, one for women and the other for male adolescents. Women high school graduates from depressed communities are able to pursue tertiary education in Manila through its scholarship program. The Day Center for Senior Citizens is a venue where lolos and lolas can spend days discovering new skills and interests. Fellowship, Art and Spiritual Nurture compose the Ministry for the Handicapped. The same program plus assistance in following up their cases is provided in the Ministry for Offenders. The Family Enrichment Program reinforces the need to enhance communication in the family to achieve a responsible, drug-free family life. Peer counseling training enables the youth to help their fellow youth in crisis. Psychological and spiritual counseling is made possible by the telephone through the Lily Telephone Counseling Center, where help is only a telephone away. The Women and Family Department also supervises students on internship in the fields of psychology and counseling. KKFI, being a foundation committed to social development, the research department conducts researches for program planning and structuring to measure the effectiveness of its programs and services and to determine the impact of social issues. It publishes the official newsletter, Ang Batigaw, and sponsors the annual oratorical and essay writing contests for students to challenge them to be involved in nation building. Its human resource development program assists the executive director in three areas of staff development: spiritual growth, social cultural activities, and continuing education. The employee.
We'll have the other. Yeah, probably we'll just stop it now. Through these activities that we have in the center, people come to know Christ. You know, after going through some of these programs that we offer them, and through pastoral care and counseling, they join any church and they will say, we are glad we came to this foundation. There's a lot more to be done, and I think the other Stray will show you are some of the most recent programs that we got into, especially into income generating programs, which we are into now because of the bad shape of our economy. These are some of the things that we are doing also for our drug abuse victims.
Job performance evaluation reviews their performance and potential in their jobs. Psychological testing is available to employees and clients. Research department also prepares project proposals for program expansion. The KKFI's Board of Trustees is composed of individuals distinguished in their views of endeavor.
You can see here one American is two Americans are members of our board of directors. The treasurer is an American.
Rosalina Iqbal Castro, a distinguished author, educator, church and community leader. The KKFI reaches out to GOs and NGOs for social concern and social action nationwide. Its philosophy of service emphasizes sharing resources or expertise needed to benefit others. In turn, it is grateful for the support and above all, the faith and the friendship from both national and international organizations, including church-affiliated funding institutions, with whom it has kept intact historical ties. This is Kapatiran Kozaran Foundation Incorporated. After 42 years, its programs, services and facilities.
This is the first building built by the missionaries in 1921.
And the incumbent administration's ever alert response to our people's need for a strongly concerned and involved partner in individual and community development. And always, its main concerns are the children. Today may ever symbolize peace and hope.
Those are typical houses in our
squatter villages. They may be our teachers, leaders, and parents. And those who have left in life, that they may grow in wisdom, in the stature, and in favor with God and His people. We invoke the Lord Harder to strengthen its management and staff, and its partner individuals and communities, and their work toward the attainment of a humane, prosperous, self-reliant, democratic and peaceful society, conscious of its heritage as a nation, and involved in the tasks to achieve quality life for all. May they celebrate many more years in their commitment to God's mission. If you need KKFI's help and want to be involved in its work, contact Kapatiran Kaunlaran Foundation Incorporated, 937 P. Paredes Street, Sampaloc, Manila. Telephone numbers 731-0111-214.
Okay. Thank you, Russ.
You're welcome.
This is one of the centers that is church-related in terms of that works closely with the people. Since we do not get enough help from the government, we try to create programs to help our own brothers and sisters. You have seen that those high-rise buildings which, you know, if there is another earthquake, I'm sure they will collapse, you know. They endured the last earthquake we had in Manila. But we are not sure if it will endure the next earthquake. One of the problems that we are faced with now is the problems on health and sanitation. In one house, sometimes there are 7 people inside in that cramped area. So you can see the enormous problems that our people are into, and how slow our church also is responding to these problems. One of the challenges of working in a social center like that is the gospel is made alive when you work directly with people. And that has made some kind of fulfillment to us in the center when children just after finishing school would say, "That is my home in Kapatiran." One of the recent touching experiences which we had was a young boy of 18 who died in our center without even knowing where his origin was. He was a homeless child. When we got him, he was 9 years old. And then he got sick of leukemia. We tried to find out. We tried to, you know, get in touch with the media, the television, and all sorts to find out his parentage. But we lost, there was no one who responded. And you know what was very touching? They themselves, the young boys themselves, were the ones who really accompanied him to the cemetery together with our pastor and, of course, our staff. And you know, from that time on, these young boys among themselves would go to the cemetery and visit him. And this has made them more, you know, more loved by the center, because they can see that it is a kind of making them feel that there is a place which they can call home. Now, one interesting, that would be another study story, but one interesting experience which we had too was on the day center for the elderly, when an 85-year-old man fell in love also with a 65-year-old lady. You know, they were kind of friends already. You know, the friendship developed, but the man suffered a heart attack. And at the time when they were planning to get married, the woman was 65, the man died. So all these experiences in our center, interesting, sometimes sad, and all of that, has enriched our lives to serve the people in such a way that the gospel, which we preach, and when we say, God is alive, then they know that He is there. Now, what are the problems of our churches now in the Philippines? Just like you here in the States, one of the problems that we are confronted with is involving more ourselves with something that is coming up in our society. The leadership crisis also, when most of our young people are not attracted anymore to the ministry. And you know, ministers retire, and who will take their places? This is one big problem that our church is faced with. It is not attractive in a sense that it does not give good pay. And I think this is one thing that materialism has done a great harm to our young people. They see the poverty that is all around, and the missionary zeal is being lost. Now, what is the church doing about this? Recently, one of the big tasks of our church is to go into what we call family ministries, where the families now try to go into these seminaries to be involved in work. Like, it's not really volunteer, but they stay there for 3 days and expose their children what it means to live in, to study in a seminary. And we're trying to get these middle-class people, because for the last 20 years, we had people who responded to the call of the ministry were people who were very poor, those who came from the provinces. And to get a degree was some kind of, you know, getting enrolled to a theological school or a Bible school. I am sure that just like you here in the United States, we will be confronted with social issues. We cannot run away from the realities that life is so dynamic among our young people today. We cannot keep our eyes blind to the realities of life, that there are universal problems that our church is faced with. It is just our wish that the church will not only increase its membership biologically, but also through a more zealous way of evangelism and presenting spiritual issues where Christ is very real among our young people. In a world where there is so much capitalism, people have lost the missionary, the zeal to serve. If our young people would not respond to this call and the old will fade away, what happens with the Protestant church? The church, which we feel could respond to some problems personally and collectively, especially in making people realize that life here is just temporal. Many of these complicated problems, whether economic, social, or spiritual, I feel are also universal, in a sense that the Philippines is not an isolated country from these problems. So, I would like to learn more from you what your churches also are doing with the lack of ministers or church workers going into ministry. I do not know if you have this problem too. No.
I don't believe we have a problem, but I don't know what class, whether you say middle class or, you know, or what particular class of the financial ability, I guess, is going into seminary. I just don't know what those statistics would be.
But you have many responding,
I don't believe there's any shortage, yes.
Because this is a real problem now in the Philippines. And with the charismatic and these fundamentalist groups, you know, being aggressive, we are losing many members from these mainline churches. there is some kind of attraction with this charismatic group. So I don't know if you have this problem too, losing members to these groups.
Yeah, that's what you were describing earlier would characterize the United States as well. The mainline churches are going down in membership, and the fundamental churches are growing. So that's true, and we have the same problem with the young people.
Same.
So, yes.
Sounded almost like you were just talking about our
church. Yeah, when you were talking, I thought you were talking about it. I mean, you sounded like you were talking about the U.S. Or
I think one of the reasons why there are enough seminarians, though, to fill the calls is that there's not a lot of church growth.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you've got as many as are retiring, coming out of seminary and ready to take calls. One of the things I've noticed in Canada, anyway, where we live, is that there's a lot of second career pastors. So people are working in another field for 15 or 20 years and then go into seminary for training.
Uh-huh.
We're finding the same thing at the Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. I think it's 60 or 70% of the class is second career people.
And a lot of women.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good. Yeah, 3 years ago we had, they had also revive what we call the diaconal ministry. Do you have this here too? Where, like myself, I can go into that because I'm a professional woman. I'm professional and I could shift. Is this what you're talking now? Where people...
No, we're talking about people who maybe worked in the government or worked in mechanics,
okay.
Or electricians.
Mm-hmm. Retired military.
Yeah. Do you pay well enough your ministers to that they are
in Canada? I would say ministers
well cared for
is low middle class. It's to be equivalent to a teacher. It would allow for buying a house, operating one or two cars. So it's adequate. There are a lot of tax breaks, so that the amount that gets paid to the minister doesn't sound as much. But when you take the tax breaks into consideration, it would be equal to a low middle class salary.
How about here in the States?
I don't think they're ever adequate, but just as in Canada, there are tax breaks and housing allowances and that mm-hmm. type of thing. But most of the younger ones, just as with every other profession, I call myself an endangered species because there are no more young people who are able to stay home. It takes two people to support a family,
uh-huh.
And that's true of ministers as well as
yeah, it's the same too. Sometimes it's the minister's wife who is earning more than the minister too in the Philippines.
Quite common.
Our minister's wife.
In Canada, I would say there are more ministers' wives who stay home.
In Canada?
Mm-hmm. You have more women in general staying home though.
Maybe. Or maybe it's just the area I live in.
Yeah. We do seem to be seeing a trend back towards more women staying home. Particularly there's a few years past five.
Well, one of the problems too that our church is faced with is some of these ministers' wives get jobs abroad and they leave the minister, you know, running the church and the parsonage, which is very, very difficult. And it has also added to the problems of the deterioration of the family life of the minister, because we always feel that the wife of a minister plays a significant role in the church life as well, you know, being looked up to as the leader of the women. And some of the wives of these ministers have gone to the Middle East or even to the States if they are nurses.
That's one of the things that they're trying to discourage here a lot is to this idea that the pastor's wife has to be a leader of the things, that she now is just, they're working towards her just being a member of the congregation.
Oh.
And,
yeah. I was going to make a comment on the same.
Uh-uh.
One of the reasons I think that there are more ministers' wives working when they do is just to get out of that role.
Uh-huh.
Not so much for financial need as to not be in the role where the congregation expects them to act as the second pastor?
Oh, yeah, that's interesting, because not so yet, you know. Probably it's just that we lack leadership yet in the church. That's why sometimes the pastor's wife takes active role in initiating some kind of activities, especially among the women, and we appreciated them for that.
So we've been talking here as if all pastors are male, and most of them still are, but in the female situation, the female pastors that I know rarely have full-time calls, so they're only getting paid for part-time work.
The women pastors?
Rarely have full-time calls.
Oh, that's another thing too.
There's quite a few of the calls that they have issued to a husband and a wife pair, and both of them kind of are a half-time thing or something. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the problems that I shared with you, you said are the same too, no? When So I think there's a trend now in the Protestant church where we are losing.
You mentioned the Protestant church not having the young ministers to come up to take that place. Is that true in the Catholic Church with their priests and so forth too, or?
No, they have more. Although the Roman Catholic Church now is also facing some kind of problems, like they would have these more progressive priests, getting into ecumenical programs where they now begin to organize what we call basic Christian communities, which would be very critical against the traditional Roman Catholic Church. We have lots of those.
See, in our Roman Catholic Church, they have a great difficulty recruiting young priests.
Oh, you.
It's just not appealing.
And I think in the Philippines, most of these young men would come from the middle and upper classes, because being a seminarian is sometimes a status symbol in the family. This is something too. I failed to mention to you that the ecumenical movement between the Roman Catholic and Protestants is not really that, I would say, balance, in a sense that it's the Protestants who would get out of their way to really become ecumenical rather than the Roman Catholics.
I think that kind of depends on what area of the country you're from here in the United States. We're from California, and everything is progressive there.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot of ecumenism.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Sharing communion.
Yeah, we felt that it was just leap. You know, it was just lip service when they say ecumenical, because they can invite us to their church, but they cannot come to our church. I mean, they refuse. They would always have a meeting ground, you know, where they don't come to our church.
And but we go. We have them even preaching the service.
Yeah, we had one give communion in our church.
I think it would interest you to know also that from the Roman Catholic Church, the mother church, predominantly, you know, in the Philippines, there was a big movement out of the church to which we call Philippine Independent Church. This was a group of priests who rebelled against this. These priests who came from these Belgian or Jesuits, and they are beginning to become a very strong member of the National Council of Churches in the Philippines. We call them Philippine Independent Church. And they're closer with the Protestants than to the Roman Catholic. And their bishop would always be a Filipino, and their forms of worship are very Filipino. They refuse to use English. So this is kind of also a getting out from the very traditional Roman Catholic. One of the things that we are beginning to observe is the Roman Catholics this time are very intent in learning the Bible than the Protestants. It's very interesting that they even know better the Bible than people who had been attending the Sunday schools. And this kind of amazes us in our Bible studies, because in our ecumenical Bible studies every Thursday, they would be more knowledgeable than those who had been in the church for some time. So you can see the increasing interest of the Roman Catholics in studying the Bible. I don't know if this is also felt here in the United States.
I've noticed
States.
That in terms of over 20 years, anyway. When people are talking about the charismatic groups, there's a strong charismatic element within our Roman Catholic and Anglican churches. And that's where the getting back to the Bible is seen more.
Yeah.
Yeah, the same thing in the mainline churches in the U.S. There have been various studies on, like the Search Institute out of Minneapolis, that, you know, the knowledge of people in the Bible in the mainline churches is dropping fairly dramatically, mm-hmm. which is not good.
Yeah, I think we have taken for granted our heritage.
One thing I've seen is that some of the churches seem to be getting so involved in social issues that all the time that they would have ordinarily spent for a Bible study, now with some kind of a discussion on some social issue. Really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the same too, you know, and people don't enjoy discussing those anymore. So they go into this kind of charismatic or fundamental groups where they feel that it's Bible-centered. I think we should be more sensitive now. I'm not sure. Although we want also to learn about these social issues, we want also to keep the tradition of using
the social issues to be theologically based.
And I think I'm not sure whether it should be the seminary who should be preparing a curriculum for that. Because sometimes our ministers get offhand also and just deal with the social issues and fail to relate spirituality in there. Well, we share the same feeling too. Russ, it's time.
I've got 20 till. I don't know if I'm too fast or slow. I got hold in time, so.
No, okay. One of the things that we're trying to watch now also is the emergence of women leaders. Recently in my church, there were about four women who had been assigned as district superintendents. And this year, we are electing our bishop. We don't know if there are two candidates, women candidates. I'm not sure if they will get it because, as I told you, it's still very patriarchal. So there is a lot of consciousness raising among women that I think it's time we will have a woman bishop. I think it, you have one already
just
in the Lutheran.
Just barely.
Yeah,
very,
and
very
it's
recent, last week.
Yeah, it was in
one in Germany just before the.
Yeah, I read that in the Resource Center, and it's interesting to watch also our elections. Although, I know that it's still difficult for our ministers to accept women as bishops. It would be interesting also to see how women would struggle, you know, to be up there too with the ministers. One of the things that interests us also is this church politics, you know, where we still encounter the perpetuation of leadership among the older people. Like a chairman of the board for 20 years, something like that. And the young people now are beginning to say, hey, why don't you place us there? And sometimes we feel threatened that when we don't get these positions, we are no longer needed. Do you have these problems too here? Where people are just get elected to several commissions or committees, and it's the same ones year in and year out, you know, getting the same position. These attitudes are
particularly the young people who have come. Now, if we move, so nobody knows our children, now they can come into our community and be accepted on their own. But when we still lived in Tucson, when our children tried to take an active leadership part in the church, they were not professional people, uh-huh. But they still were Bev and Byron's kids.
Oh, the identification is very strong.
The identification is so good. So they, you know, moved to other churches where they could establish leadership roles.
Yeah.
Not other denominations.
That is also interesting, you know, the leadership that we have in church politics. I don't know how, one of the things that we are trying to correct now is elections has really gone offhand. When I say offhand, sometimes people want to perpetuate their leadership, so they kind of campaign. It was not like before when, you know, that if Ras is supposed, is qualified for that, you just raise your hand and say you just vote. People now really get their way through and say, I want this position, I want this position, and they just, you know, love to campaign. And this is something that our, you know, church politics has already been practiced. There is no difference between the government and the way church is being run now. I don't know if you encounter that problem too here.
We definitely have a budgetary problem. We never have enough money.
Oh, sure. In our place too, you know. Money is, well, lately our churches has been quite active in this tithing, you know, because people never... there is always a question, when to, what is tithing? You know, this has really been quite discussed, and yet people would really be confused. How much is there to go into tithe? I don't know if this has been discussed also in your churches. But our young people will say, how do we tithe?
My son would say, why do I have to tithe?
Yeah. Why do we have to tithe, you know? Just like my little boy, when he saw the offering plate passed in, and he said, when I would grow older, I'll become a minister, and those money will be mine. He thought that the money in the offering plate was all the ministers. Well, I'm very glad that we share the same concerns. You know, it gives me a kind of feeling that it's not only the Philippine church with these problems, you know, the losing of membership, the losing of ministers because they want to come here. In fact, I just learned that in Iowa, there are 4 young Filipino ministers there now. So the drain, you know, the Western life is very attractive to Filipinos.